And welcome to episode 28 of Tabletop Game Talk, a show where we talk about tabletop games of all types. I'm one of your hosts, Josh.
I'm Chris.
And I'm Kitty.
Today we'll be talking about playing to win, but first we'll go off topic, starting with some news, announcements, and feedback.
Yes, we will. So we have two new patrons, one friend of the show, Charles Finch. Welcome and thank you. And then Brian Arnold. In addition, thank you, Emil, Jill Jam, and Lucas Hartso for being friends of the shows as well. So when I said I put a cap on that for our $5 level, I didn't realize it was going to be the one that filled up the fastest. So
yeah.
Not limiting it. I'm not increasing it, though. So two more spaces. That's it. If you want to be a patron, just go ahead and visit our Patreon page at tabletopgametalk.com/Patreon. The biggest advantage is you get free bonus entries into all of our contests and automatic entry into all our contests.
Which right now is a big deal because Gloomhaven is hot and that is our giveaway at the moment.
It is indeed. So we're just going to jump right to the Gloomhaven contest. This is week 2 of 3. The way this works is each week we will tell you what to email us to get an entry into the contest. Again, you can also get entries if you're a patron. You can also get entries if you let me know that you wrote an iTunes review, or if you fan our page on BoardGameGeek. That'll give you bonus entries as well. This week, I would like you to email me with a quick question. So at the top of every show, or at least in the off-topic segment, we answer a quick question. These are questions that we can answer in maybe 5 to 10 minutes. Some of them get occasionally promoted to entire show topics, but we're looking for quicker questions where it's, you know, we can do a quick answer to it as well. Anything is valid, preferably around games, but I'll answer any questions. What's your favorite food? I'll answer it. I'm not going to answer it now. Someone would have to ask it. That's the other announcements. I did an interview today with Matt and Anton from Hyacinth Games regarding a role-playing game / tabletop miniatures game called Wreck Age, spelled Wreck space Age. And they're doing a Kickstarter coming up on March 17th. So that interview will be out. You'll be hearing this on Tuesday. That interview will be out on Friday. So we kind of talked about the mechanics of the game, where it came from, how it started. And coincidentally, they just lived down the street from us.
Oh, that's too funny.
That's yep. Right.
So I told them that they need to have me over so I can actually play the game with them, their creators, for a little bit. So they're releasing a vehicle expansion, vehicle miniatures. So that should be a really cool. Check out that interview. It was over Skype, so most of the interview sounds just fine, but it's Skype, so occasionally you'll hear Skype-like sounds. Let's see. A YouTube update. We got so much feedback. I mean, it was the Gloomhaven entry for last week, is to send us feedback on our unboxing. So we got a lot of feedback. The things that I'm going to summarize all of this. Sound, still working on sound. I got some lapel mics that should be for future unboxings, make the sound better. Apparently, the furnace was kicking on and off in the background from time to time, and I did not realize it. So.
Well. It's so cold in here.
It was cold. We turned the furnace off for recording purposes now.
I'm wearing 3 layers of pants and 2 layers of socks because of your freezing house, Chris.
I'm not wearing enough layers. I'm freezing.
I'm still cold.
All for the sake of good sound.
It is.
True.
A few people pointed out the reflection. So these are like hidden gems if you didn't notice it. In the video, there's a reflection of the camera because we did it during the day. So the light came in from the window, showed the reflection of the camera on the back on the glass of the bookcases. So now I have blackout curtains, which also should help with the sound echo. Let's see what else. Second camera, we now have 2 cameras, and I have a tripod set up so I can do close-ups and cutaways and things like that. I'm not going to do a lot of editing for our podcast YouTube videos. There'll be a little bit of editing, but splitting it into 2 segments is the majority of it. But for unboxings and other YouTube specific videos, not following the no editing rule, so we'll be doing a lot more editing on that. Let's see, other people, and most of them were grasping when they said this, the length of the video, it was long, but it was also Gloomhaven, so
it's an exceptional game.
Yeah.
Did you see that box?
It's 18 pounds. So
it's the size of 3 normal games. So of course it's 3 times as long.
Exactly. Most of our videos we're probably going to keep between 15 and 25 minutes. So And then we got a few positive comments as well. They liked the fact that there were multiple people, so we could kind of, you know, one of them was Kitty was looking up a rule as I was continuing to go on, so we could refer back. It didn't pause. Explaining the game as we were going. So I don't think I want to do, like, just pure unboxings, like, look at all these components, because that's kind of boring. I am going to know how to play the game at least by reading the rule book so we can describe the components as they come out. And we may even do some other more interesting mixes and stuff if I can get everything working. So we tried doing some stuff tonight, so we'll see if that turns out. Let's see. I just already mentioned the Gloomhaven contest. Again, email us, quick question, and March 12th is the deadline on that. If you are unfamiliar with Gloomhaven, you're living under a rock, but it's a huge, 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 epic legacy-style fantasy game that just goes on and on and on. It is the current hotness that's on Board Game Geek, has been pegged at the top. It's just crazy, and it is crazy hard to find. I don't check eBay, so I just hear rumors, but I hear it's like up to $400+ right now. So I accidentally ordered two copies. I'm giving away one of those copies. It'll be worth having, I promise. Let's see here. Wait update. This week was my birthday week. Means three lunches, two dinners, multiple drinks. I'm still down.
Yeah.
I am now 193.8, down 1.1 pounds, total of 21.2 pounds. I made it.
That's awesome. Yeah, I did some drinking. I was there at your thing and some other drinking on different days. And yeah, I'm still down 0.6. This week and 7.5 overall.
Yeah. Yeah. The trick is just to, you know, starve yourself at all other times.
Yes.
Yeah.
So. Works a treat.
Easy. Easy stuff.
Mm.
Okay. Moving right along. iTunes reviews. Thanks, Library Gamer. Thanks, CMU. I'm just going to pronounce it that way. It's got to be Odin. UK Pitta. This was one of my favorites. UK asked if Josh was really British.
Do you know, that's so funny, because the first time I ever visited America, one of Gloria's friends told me, people aren't going to believe that your accent is real. And literally in the parking lot, as she was saying that, someone was like, oh, nice accent, buddy. I was like, how did you call that? Yeah, it happens a lot. No, it's real.
Yeah. No, we should have you say... Josh is really good at American accents, too. One of these days, we're going to do the intro with Josh doing it in an American accent.
I'll give it a go, yeah.
Apparently, just add some twang to it. One Rain and Matt VB. Thank you all. Josh, why don't you talk for a little
Indeed.
Bit?
Indeed. Well, Dan has given us some feedback on episode 27, the solo games. He says, hey, Chris, Josh, and Kitty. Love your YouTube channel and podcast. As a new dad, I rarely get an opportunity to leave the house to game, so I usually set up a solo game on weekends. Some of my favorites are Eldritch Horror, Mansions of Madness, Second Edition, and Descent Second Edition, both with the app. Gloomhaven looks like an epic adventure, one which I'd really greatly enjoy. P.S. Kitty and Josh need to pull their weight. Winky face. Keep up the great content.
No, I think that's anger face.
No, it was definitely a winky face. Just tongue in cheek.
That might have been a typo.
Yeah, we know. We do. It's true.
I actually did not consider the too busy to get a group of people together solo play. Also, I did not consider the games that use apps for the one versus many. So both Eldritch Horror and Mansions of Madness are normally one person takes on the... not the protagonist, but the bad guy side. And then you play against other groups. But now Mansions of Madness 2 and apparently Descent, you can play the game full co-op, which, again, those games are like story-driven, so they make an interesting game to play. I like that idea. And Gloomhaven, I have no problem playing that game solo and enjoying it. Like I say, I think it's just because of the progressive campaign style where it feels like I'm actually doing something. So thanks, Dan.
All right, from Enzo. He asked about Gloomhaven. I would love for you to discuss how you can replay the game if you use all the stickers and items given this is a legacy game.
Yep. So this is a good question. It could be. This is a good quick question, but it's relevant to our current contest, so I wanted to throw it in here. Gloomhaven is a legacy game. It does have instructions to rip up certain cards at times. I actually just have a little card pouch that is removed cards. So instead of ripping it up, I put the card in that removed pouch, so now it's gone. The stickers
on the board really don't affect gameplay of the scenarios. They just are markers of scenarios you've unlocked.
Right.
So it doesn't... you can go ahead and add those or not as you'd like. I've seen some people kind of have their own little campaign scenario checkmark sheets ready to go.
Yeah, because the stickers, all of the stickers, almost all, I'll tell you one that's not, but all the stickers that go on the board is just campaign tracking. They don't have any effect on actual gameplay. So like Kitty said, you could track it all with a campaign sheet. You could like really don't need the board or the stickers at all. You can just write everything down.
They're just fun.
But they are fun. And I would recommend doing it because the board just kind of like comes to life as you unlock all these different things. So, but once you've done that once, if you really want to replay again, just don't put the stickers on the board and use the campaign sheet. The one thing that is permanent is the enhancement stickers, which go on the cards of the characters. And those enhancement stickers are even stay there for characters that you might start at first level of that same kind. So just treat that as a bonus. Like, we've played the game once through or starting over again. Well, keep your enhancement stickers. That's really the only thing that you'd have to remove if you wanted to start from scratch. And the stickers do remove fairly cleanly if you want to do that. I suppose you could put the stickers on the sleeves that are sleeving the cards, and that way you could take the sleeves off if you wanted to do that as well. So just depends on how purist you want to be. Honestly, though, if you get through this game and say, I want to play it again, just back the next... Yeah. Just back the next Kickstarter that's going to be up in a couple months and get another copy by the end of the year, because there's a lot of content in here. All right, Josh.
So from Sam from New York, on six-player games, for groups interested in gaming but not hobbyists, a game like Clue, or Cluedo for Josh, would have name recognition and could be the springboard to less well-known games. Depending on the group, I'd also suggest games like Suro, For Sale, Quirkle, King of Tokyo, Seven Wonders, Sushi Go Party, or Zombie Dice. I bought Suro to the high school I work at, and several teachers jumped in, and at least two bought a copy over the holidays to play with their families.
Yeah, I think he answered that question better than we did as far as six-player games.
Yeah, that's thanks, Sam. Great list. Sam continues, I did give my wife Lotus for a present, and she thought it was a sweet gesture, reminding me that we have two children and little time to play games. However, after listening to your podcast, I also got her a copy of Patchwork, which she loved and is happy to play because of the Tetris-like feel. So far, as gift go, that's one win and one meh. Thanks for the help in selecting Patchwork.
Yay. So nice. Samira, thanks for the help in answering the six-player games, and I'm glad you're enjoying Patchwork.
All right, from Trevor. As a note for winning solo games, I really like the solo winning conditions for Vinhas. While you do have victory points as part of the way to win, the game requires you to beat the AI in several categories in order to have mastered the game.
Yeah, so we talked about solo games and just kind of the different ways of having win conditions and whatnot. I have not looked at Vinhas, but now I really want to look at that. But it sounds to me like you are trying to achieve a certain score, but you also have to get certain objectives complete for that score to even qualify. So I kind of like that too.
Yeah, I like that, where it's kind of you have to tick off, like, I especially like if you have your choice of objectives, like you can meet 3 out of these 5 objectives to end the game.
Yep.
That way you have a little more flexibility in play. Makes a little bit more sense.
Yeah, I like that a lot. So I also got something from Andrew Hoffman. He mentioned on Twitter that Flip City is a really good solo game. And I've only played Flip City in 2+ players, but I can see how it can be a really fun solo game because it has a push your luck mechanic. As you're flipping over these cards, you're trying not to have too many of a particular danger symbol or... so you kind of are trying to maximize your city in a certain number of turns. So I could see that. Let's see. I have a note on feedback in general. We love your feedback. We're going to start paraphrasing some of the emails. So if we don't read your email and if I don't respond to you, because sometimes I'll just respond to you directly on email, it doesn't mean we're not reading it. We read every single one of them. We'll just only be able to show some of them just... because Kitty says, we're getting too long and off topic. I blame Kitty, but it's really true.
I have to go to bed.
All right. Speaking of, we'll just move right along.
All right. So our quick question of the day is from Lucas. Y'all mentioned standalone apps for games a few times, which got me thinking, how do you guys feel about games with companion apps like XCOM, Mansions of Madness 2, Alchemists? Do you think that it detracts too much from the tactile satisfaction of the game? If not, are there any games that you think would be improved the most by having a companion app created for it?
So, Josh, you like apps. Mm-hmm. Kitty, you like apps. I love apps. I actually have no problem with apps in my board game. And I actually bought another game. I will get to it in just a second. It depends on how it's used, right? XCOM, for example.
That's true.
I think the XCOM app is a great way to run that game. It's almost like it's just an external timer, but it's also kind of guiding you through. I have been told many times that Mansions of Madness 2nd Edition is great. I have the 1st edition where you have to manually run it, but the 2nd edition, you have the app. There have been mixed reviews on that one. Some of the puzzles are only in the app. They're not actually on the table at all. But again, other people are like, they love that because you don't have to fiddle with all the different puzzles. You can just gather around the app and see what's going on there. For solo play, I think I'd want to have an app that keeps me honest.
I think sometimes it can detract a little bit. I mean, I had never played Ticket to Ride, but I kind of downloaded the app thinking, oh, this is the game that everyone says is a great gateway game. And for some reason, it was really uninspiring, and me and Gloria ended up not playing it. Yeah. So
that wasn't a companion app, though. That was a replacement, so that was basically a digital port.
I'm with you.
So the companion apps can be helpful in kind of guiding you through. I mean, if you think about it, even Magic the Gathering, like a life counter app is a companion app. I wouldn't necessarily mind a Gloomhaven companion app where it takes care of all the drawing the monster cards. That would be kind of cool.
Spencer had a really fun Settlers of Catan app that gave you fun maps.
Yeah, board
like,
setups.
Yeah, board setups that will make gameplay like they're easy, difficult, different levels of play for different styles.
Yeah, and I think Dominion, which is, you know, you're picking a bunch of cards from a card pool. That one is a really good one to have as a like a companion app that will pick those, and you can set up different parameters. So for setup, I think companion apps are fantastic. So let's see. Games I own new stuff. Someone mentioned Ashes last week, so I now own that.
Our listeners aren't doing very well with helping you with your addiction.
No, they're really, really not. It's not good. But it does play up to 4 players, so I'm going to get you guys to play.
I'm down.
Try it out. Not Alone, which is a 2-7 player, 1-vs-many, small box card game. So it's not really social deduction. There's actually no social deduction in it. One person plays the creature, and the other players play the hunted. And the creature's trying to, like, kill all the hunted.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah, and like I said, it's a small box, but it's another one of those games where I think that when you get that group of just a little bit too big, you can kind of go to this. And since it's just a deck of cards and a very small board and some counters that you put on it, it means you can set it up very quickly and tear it down very quickly.
Nice.
And then Expeditions was the one I got, where this one is a role-playing game card game. It comes with some cards and a D20 and then a link to the app. And the app actually runs you through the story, and you use the cards to build your characters and to use abilities and stuff. The concept was interesting enough to me where, again, it was just a small box game. I'm like, I'm going to pick this up just to check it out. Kickstarter. Oh God. So I'm definitely addicted to Kickstarter. It's sad. I want to mention Champions of Midgard, the expansions again, just because, we got a chance. Kitty, you played Champions of Midgard with me.
I did. Just this weekend.
Yep. And it reminded me how much I actually like this game. So like
the one with the ships and stuff.
Yep. So I'm really looking forward to the expansions now. So it's funded, like, I think 2,000%. I don't know. He has for like 10,000. He has like 200,000 or something crazy right now. Thunderstone Quest. I've brought this up before. This is kind of a deck building. It is a deck building game, but it's the third iteration of this game. And they've kind of streamlined the rules. They've added quests to it. It added a little bit of a legacy element to it. Thunderstone Quest, if you like deck building games, this is the game to go back right now. It is going to be huge when it is released. It's AEG, so they're a solid game company. They're not going to not deliver on this, so check it out. Super Hot. I just saw it, so I clicked fund. Quad Heroes, though, this one is, looks really cute. So this is a 1-7 game where it has miniatures that are like little cutesy cubes. And you're trying, it's scenario based. So you're trying to get through puzzles of, you know, you'd be racing. You could be trying to, you know, pick up and deliver those kind of things. By the time you hear this, it'll only be one day left. But take a look at this game. If you do any Kickstarters, take a look at this game. This also has the potential to have to be fairly popular when it comes out. It has some interesting mechanics as far as when you move, you actually flip your cubed character forward or sideways or whatever direction you want to move. And depending on how he's sitting, if he's on his face, if his feet are up, if he's on his left side or whatever, that'll activate different kind of moves. So it's just like this interesting puzzle game and puzzle mechanic. And it has like user creatable scenarios as well. So that I thought this cool. one was cool.
That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And that's a lot of players for a game.
Yeah.
Yep. You rarely see seven.
Like, especially 1-7. And like it's an interesting.
Interesting number. I'm interested to see how it plays.
Yep.
All right. On to our game of today.
If you're watching on the video, you see
Assault of the Giants. So we sat down with Sydney and just played this one, and I lost. Well, but Josh lost more.
Josh did lose more.
I horrendously lost because I was the horribly colored and horribly ugly disfigured clan, which I already said before we started playing was clearly going to be the worst clan, which I still believe they are. So that's marred my experience a little bit. I could see me getting into this more if I played a different clan.
Yeah. So it was our first game. Josh and I did an unboxing of this. That's on YouTube. This was the first game we played of it. And we did actually record the entire game session from an overhead camera. I'm not going to release a 3-hour play session, but I might release the time lapse of it because I didn't realize how much fun it is to watch time lapse video of board games. But so I'm going to do something with that video. Like I said, we're trying to work out how we're going to do unboxings and how to plays and stuff. So that you'll see this game in one form or another. The game is essentially a victory point gathering game. They're called ordering points in the game. You can move around. Fighting is a great way to get victory points, but everyone has their own personal goals to be able to get victory points that way. You have spells, you have different events that happen, you have resources that can make spells better or make you better in combat. The giant figures are essentially these just brutish. Each side has two giants, and they kind of take all the damage before anyone else in your group takes damage. You have these champions, you have leaders, you have regular giants, then you have the small folk, and you have giant hunters, and there was a lot going on in this game.
There was a lot going on, but the scoring felt very easy at the end for a point salad kind of game, because you literally pick up your points as you score them, and you just have a stack of points that you count.
Right.
There's no... You've got a giant here, so you get three. There's none of that. It's just game's over. Those are your points.
Yep. Lots of ways to earn victory points, and then you just count up the pile of chips in front of you at the end. The gameplay was really fast. Like, it took us probably an hour to learn the game. But once we started playing, you could take your turn in a matter of, like, less than a minute more often than not.
Yeah, the moves were very easy. There's only a set number of moves. I think 8, was it? That you could do
nine
different moves, but each one has a card. And it was very intuitive, and it wasn't too hard for me to pick a decision and go with it. Yep. Plus, you're also kind of being ushered into a certain direction with each clan.
Right, because this is very asymmetrical. Every giant type has a different way of gaining victory points outside of combat. So you're kind of like focusing on that direction. And yeah, you have 9 cards. You have 9 cards in your hand. You play them, and there's one rest card. So once you play your rest card, you can pick up all the other cards that you previously played. So you have like move, attack, pillage, magic, those type of things. And they also have interrelations to each other. So the later you play some cards, the better they are. And some cards, the earlier you play them, the more effect you're going to get from it. So you can kind of have some synergies on how you play those cards. So I really did like the game. I think that there was so much going on that in the first game, it was hard to even know where to go or what to do. But this one, if you like giants and you like D&D, I think it really captures the theme and fun. And that area control, territory control is kind of fun. And also having the giant slayers running around and killing each other.
If you want a really difficult challenge, play the Hill Giants. That's all I'm going to say.
Josh, I'm going to play the Hill Giants, and you can pick any... three other races, and I'll still...
Well, I would know how to play them better now that I've played them once.
I was just about to say that Josh was all down on the Hill Giants. I knew that Chris was going to play the Hill Giants next time we played this game.
Oh, yeah. Sure, of course he will. Yeah. Yeah. But you understand the game very well. Like, as your first time playing Hill Giants, oh, God.
I mean, this was my first time playing, though.
No, I get it. But
well, and the reason, so part of the things, that there's Storm Giants, Cloud Giants, Stone Giants...
Fire
Giants, Frost Giants, and Hill Giants. And they're kind of similar in that order. That's not quite in the order. But the Hill Giants are the weakest by far in combat. They can have the most giants in one area, but they're the weakest by far. And you got points by eating food more than anything else. You get 2 points for eating food. And getting that engine together to get the food is important. But you had a really hard time attacking anyone because you just didn't have enough strength. So I think that there is definitely trying to figure out how do you work the best, the numbers, so that you can attack the bigger things. So, but I thought it was good.
I enjoyed it.
Josh, you're going to have to make something up because I did not put a whole blurb.
That's fine. I can make something up. It's all good.
So we're going to see where Josh is going to improv here, but I will press this button first.
In this episode, we're talking about Playing to Win. It's the title of David Serlin's book of the very same name, which is loosely based on Sun Tzu's The Art of War and how that applies to gaming.
Nice. Very nice. So this is actually from Mish's email. So this is email feedback. And what do you guys think? So we've talked about this before. Our gaming groups and player types, we talked a lot about play styles and stuff like this. Mm-hmm. What to you is playing to win, and why would you ever not play to win?
Playing to win to me, I mean, it's different for different people, I think. If you want to go really hardcore, like say David Serlin, who made the book Playing to Win, you would say you do anything to win. And that's what playing to win is. And you don't be affected by meta game influences that might be, for instance, we talked about different player types affecting the way that you play. For instance, Kitty can be a bad loser sometimes, and maybe me and Chris might be like, oh no, we don't want to make her angry. It could be conceived as that hardcore, I got to do anything to win.
Is that just my play to win strategy, though? I get attacked less because I'm known to be a bad sport.
It could be a very overt, smart, Machiavellian.
So,
just
and
been
this
conning you guys the whole time.
Yeah. Exactly. And this leads to Mish's question. So I'm going to read his email here. Now, this came in a long time ago, February 7th. January 26th. But it's such a good email that I'm like, all right, we're going to find a slot for this. So it continues. We did this first part on that episode way back then. I was really interested in your talk about metagaming and how one of you mentioned you will sometimes change your choice of action in a game based on how the other players might react emotionally. It is letting the outside world impact the game world. So just as we were talking, to some degree, that ties into what Serlin talks about in his podcast, which is the idea of optimal play. Optimal play, as I understand it, is the best move you can make in a game to ensure your victory. It is playing the game to win it, the very reason d'etre of the game.
D'etre.
Okay.
French. The reason of being.
Yes. When you play optimally, you would disregard other players' emotional reactions. You would just do what most ensures victory. I find it interesting that other players' personalities can coerce someone into playing suboptimally, so as not to make those other players angry or discourage them. It's putting the brakes on winning to spare others' feelings. So, does doing that not give sore losers an advantage over more even-keeled players? What that leads me to wonder is, how fair is it then to be one coercing the others? How fair is it to be the sore loser? Is it not manipulative? Where is the line that divides an outright threat, such as if I win, I will hit you, with something more subtle, like becoming cold and withdrawn whenever the other player starts to win? Being a sore loser seems to be part of the metagaming gray zone. So, and we'll address all this, and Kitty wants to go ahead.
Life isn't fair. You don't have to be fair.
Well, I mean, this is...
I don't know how often I say this to my preschool class as they say, I wanted the red scissors. Life isn't fair. You get what you get and you don't get upset.
So wait, I don't understand. Life isn't fair, so you have to put up with me being a bad loser? Or life isn't fair, don't worry about me being a bad loser and just beat me and it's fine.
Or do we say that to bad losers? Life isn't fair.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Also, we're not pointing this at you, Kitty.
No, we shouldn't. You're fine.
I will take the... I am a sore loser. I have owned my title. I'm not as bad as I once was. I think that I, with each day, mature into being less of a board flipper. But there is still that part of me that just... when I'm losing, it's not even when I lose a game, it's when I feel like I can't win the game, that it's just not any fun anymore. And it's usually not with...
It depends on the group a little bit.
It really depends on the group. I hate smug players.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
And they make me just want to walk away from the table and shake the board before I do.
Yep.
Well, that also ties into kind of how you go about winning. And I suppose, you know, this the way we've defined it so far in this very narrow, you know, surely to play to win is just to win the game. But, you know, what does it mean to win at a game, right? So you could say, okay, winning at the game is getting the most points defined by the rules. Or maybe winning the game is everyone having a great time.
I love that. I wanted to make that point in some way, but you made it way better. Mm-hmm. Like, there are different ways of winning.
Yeah.
Right. Having a good time while playing a game, everybody wins. I play a lot of Dungeons and Dragons. And one of the things that people ask me who don't play Dungeons and Dragons is, you know, did you win? It's like, well, we all had fun. So, yes.
Right.
That doesn't stop at board games. Like, did you win? Well, I didn't get the most points, but I definitely had a great time playing. So, in a way, yes.
So I mean, you see it even in life. I mean, you know, Uber has done a couple of things recently where they, business-wise, were probably winning, but then it turns off their customers, you know? Like, you can see the parallels in life where you can win, but then almost backfire and not really win.
Yeah, there's more than one game, and that's where we talk about the metagame.
It's true.
Yeah.
Because at some point, the reason that I've stopped being such a sore loser is because no one wants to play with you. If they're afraid of making a move and upsetting you, and now Kitty's not speaking to me, they're not going to play a game with you anymore. Yeah. And have I really won?
Yeah.
I may have won the game, but, you know, no one's going to play with me ever again.
And we know, having played with you, that you're only upset for 5 minutes and then it's fine. You know, and that's why we're happy to play with you as much as possible. You know,
I think our metagame episode was, I think it was like 19.
Right.
That's a great episode to listen to. The player type episode was a few episodes before that. That's also a great episode because we did not mean for that episode to be what it was, which is essentially us looking at everyone else's like player types, you know, that we would go. And that was just, it was an awakening moment. And all of us, I think, became better players after analyzing how we are.
It's true. And perhaps not analyzing what we are, but having the others analyze for you.
Yes.
Because it's really kind of hard to look at yourself in the mirror and see that. But we were all very open and honest with each other. Yeah. And we all took it to heart a bit.
Yep. And I think, we'll still call people each other out on it. And, like, Josh and I will still apologize to Kitty before we do something, you know, that's in the game mean. But we still do it.
And then, and people will tell me, hey, hurry up, Josh. You're taking long again.
Yep.
You AP analyze paralysis person.
We always add 10 minutes of Josh time to the playtime of any game.
I mean, this has gotten blown out of what... I feel like as I get more experienced in board games, this is becoming less of a thing. But you guys like to bring it up anyway, just for the comedy effect.
It is. Actually, I would say Assault of the Giants, I don't think any of us were waiting. Like, occasionally when we were going to do an attack, something would... take a little bit longer, but that would be about it.
Yeah.
And so those are good games where it's just like a quick decision and you go.
But
it's
funny. I did a couple miscounting and take my turn backs, but I still felt like I was doing stuff on the board, so no one really noticed.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was just thinking, like, you know, we're talking about the metagame and how, you know, people can use the metagame as a way to win. You know, you were talking about playing to win. You can use that to your advantage. You know, the idea of using some things outside of the game, some way to annoy a player that might not even be part of the rules. Like, for instance, the thing that I normally bring up in this situation was a Scrabble tournament player who would use Hawaiian words to trick people into challenging him a lot. And then when they did and they got it wrong, then he would then start playing really incorrect false words and it would really frustrate
them. Playing the mind game.
Yeah, it's all that psychological warfare thing. And, you know, so that's outside of the game, but that's also playing to win.
Yeah. Well, Mish goes on. So he's like, does it become an advantageous strategy to act like a sore loser in case it makes other players play suboptimally? I guess the risk is that others might not want to play games with you anymore, as Kitty just mentioned, if you take it too far. I don't know the answers here, but I find it interesting how we're constantly playing some middle ground, constantly negotiating and renegotiating how far we will go and how much we will pull back when we play games with other people. I play suboptimally sometimes with my son, who is 8. He likes Pokemon card game. I play it with him. If I beat him a few times in a row, I can see him start to get sad. I'll throw an occasional game just to make him feel better. To be fair, just as often he destroys me honestly. At the same time, I talk to him about it and I ask him, why play a game if you're not prepared to lose? So there's another paragraph, but I think that's a good place to pause for a moment. Playing with people, what Kitty was saying, is it's not only being a sore loser that can make people not want to play with you. If you are so much better than them and they have no chance of winning at all, the game becomes not fun for them.
Yep.
So again, maybe I do play suboptimally sometimes because I don't want to make a game that's unfun. If I'm, and most of the time this is not the case, I promise there's been some debate.
Your partner's probably listening in thinking, you better not go easy on me, Chris. Sydney's like, you dare go easy on me.
I rarely do this, I promise. But sometimes I will. If I played a game a dozen times and I'm introducing new people, I'm not going to play at that, you know, master level that I might be.
Well, it's not going to be fun for you either.
Right. You know.
It can be very frustrating if, especially in a two-player game, one player has so much more knowledge and is so much better at the game that it feels like it can't be even.
Right.
That's very, very, very hard. And sometimes it's very difficult to find someone who can play at your level. I know we had this problem with Dice Masters, where I would go to work and come home and Chris had a brand new strategy and it was just too frustrating for me to play anymore. Yeah.
Well, and the thing is, I liked playing with Kitty, though, because I was excited about the game because I had someone who would play it with me. The problem is that excitement took me to a point where I'm like doing all this research and all this optimizing and all this stuff. And then the person I'm playing with is no longer having fun because now I'm playing to win.
Because once again, if you feel like you can't even have a chance, it just also that game was very luck dependent. And I felt like I was just like in a cold streak or something. I was getting all of the bad rolls. And Chris was just like, oh, look, I rolled exactly what I needed.
And I'll do this and I'll buy that and I'll get this. And I just drew these two more things. And by the way, you're dead.
Yeah. It was almost Yu-Gi-Oh! Like in my quick deaths every time.
And I haven't played a game with her since on Dice Masters. I've actually since stopped collecting Dice Masters because it's one of those things where I will spend the time to play it, but everyone I'm playing it with is more casual. And I just don't have the time to go out and play against hardcore players. It's not as much fun either. In this situation,
people would normally kind of progress into tournament play, right? You know, because then they are going to progressively get those challenges that they need and they want to get better at this one game.
Yeah.
But in tournament play, you really have to be like, that's your game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think this happens with Magic too. Any dual game, especially where you reach a certain level, it either that's your game that you play, that's what you do on weekends, that's where you are the weeknight that they do it at your local gaming store, whatever it is, that's your game.
Yeah.
But if you want to stay a person who plays lots of games, who does whatever, you kind of just let it go.
Yeah, oh, completely understand. And there's definitely two different types of people. But some people do want to be the grandmaster of magic, just like you can be a grandmaster in chess or whatever game it is.
Yep.
And I think, you know, when David Serlin made the game, made the book Playing to Win, you know, that's who he was trying to speak to, was those hardcore people who are like, I'm going to dedicate myself to this game. I love this game and I want to be the very best. And he's giving you tactics and ways to play to win, yeah, and really understand what that philosophy should be.
I will say one of the fun things I have with people who, and no offense to people out there who do, like, I play a game only to win, but I do enjoy beating those people way more than beating anyone else. Because, like, I've said this before, whether I win or lose has very little bearing on whether or not I enjoy the game. But if somebody is so into it and wants to win so bad, and the smug player that Kitty was talking about, I want to beat them.
Yeah.
And I just enjoy that more than anything
else. Well, it sounds like you want to wipe the smugness off their face, yes, right? Yeah. Rather than just playing someone decent.
I hate losing to them even more.
Yeah.
As much as I want to beat them, I really just don't want to lose to them.
Yeah.
This leads me to an incredible story. It focuses on me, so it has to be, right?
Right.
I'm in Vegas. Most people are familiar with Texas Hold'em. And I'm playing at Vegas. I'm playing at like a $1, $2 table or something like that, a relatively small stakes. And we're having a good time. And, you know, when you're playing at a low stake table, like, people are just talking, having fun. Well, there was a higher stake table. They were like playing 10, 20. And that table didn't have enough players. So they broke up and they came over to our table. When you have people that are like essentially playing 10 times the betting amount come to this tiny little table, this one guy just kept, every single round, just max betting, max betting, max betting. And it was just infuriating because he was essentially just bullying us all out. And one hand, and screw this, I'm just going to call him. Yep, call. I had a pair of kings. So I had a king.
That's a very strong hand.
I had a king, queen in my hand, and there was a king on the board. I had a pair of kings. And I'm just like, nope, I'm just going to keep betting it. Whatever he does, I'm going to keep calling. I wasn't seeing anything besides that pair of kings and how much that smug person over there was angering me. When all the cards were flipped up, I flipped up my cards and everyone looks down and I had actually drawn a royal straight flush.
No way.
I accidentally.
That's the strongest hand in the game.
It is one of the most rare things that will ever happen, because normally, even if you have the cards for it, people will fold out before you get it. I didn't even realize what I had until the rest of the table told me.
That's crazy. Because you were just singly focused.
I was just singly focused on beating that smug guy. Yeah. So it was a great way to do it. I ended up winning like $65 on the table. And then if you got certain hands, you got to spin a wheel. And I won another $200 on the wheel. But that was the better part, was just putting it to this guy. It's like, all right, fine, whatever. Yeah, I'm still in it. You just witnessed your first royal straight flush at a table that you were at. And you were on the wrong side of that.
Thinking there's ways to counteract some things. Like, we're talking about the metagame and maybe, like, you know, sore losers affecting you. There was a thing that David Serlin mentions. He gives it a name, but essentially it's the I know that you know that I know situation.
Okay.
So, you know, if I know that someone, Kitty, is going to be upset by, you know, people attacking her or beating her, then maybe I can hold back in a three-player game and let Chris attack her so that she's the closest player to him and it makes sense for him to attack her, and I'm using that. And then it can kind of go into this, like, double bluff scenario where you're kind of thinking two steps ahead. I mean, have you ever got into those situations? Are there any games that you can think? I know chess is kind of a bit like that, but I don't know if there's any other games that really lend themselves to that.
Risk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Risk is a big one where I'm going to sit back and let... This was, I think, one of the first games that I ever learned that my sore loseriness made me something of a target, because my sister and my cousin would almost play like this game where they would try to bait each other into attacking me, because whoever attacked me first, I would just decimate them.
Right.
But I would spread myself thin so then they could come in and the remaining army would take me out.
Right.
And that was kind of a good strategy for a while. And then I realized, like, I was spreading myself too thin. I couldn't play with that strategy. It never worked out for me.
Right.
I had to kind of take that mental step back. But I was like 11 at the time, so.
Yeah.
You learn fast at that age. I think, I mean, and that works for almost any area control game, really, especially for any game where it's last man standing. So things like, and I think a lot of our games have come from where Risk was, where one person wins, to like Assault of the Giants, where at the end you count your points. And that this type of game is a harder, it's a harder game to do manipulation with, because I really don't want you fighting Kitty, because that means you're going to get points and I don't actually benefit from that anymore. So somehow there has to be constant pressure. But, and back to Assault of Giants, because that was our game today, but what this does is I don't actually have to attack Kitty to win. In fact, in many cases, there are better options for me. So maybe it's easier for me to manipulate other things. You know, a semi-failed attack is way better than a successful attack or a successful defense. So maybe I want to manipulate those kind of situations.
Yeah, I didn't think you actually attacked many actual players. I felt like you were going for the NPCs a lot in that game.
I went up to the NPCs because I was going for a particular event. And from that point, there was maybe two other attacks where I'm like, oh, that's a lot of points sitting there, and I can just grab those real quick. But let's see. There's a few more paragraphs from Mish. I just want to throw it in. You had a...
Oh, I just wanted to revisit letting kids win.
Yes.
That's not allowed in my family.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
It's, yeah. It's,
that's hardcore.
Yeah. My mother never let us win, ever. And I think I inherited my sore loseriness from her. She's also a very sore loser. But she also taught us, like, you know, that doesn't mean that you get to ruin the game for other people.
Right.
And that even if you lose, you know, I think that I was the child she taught this lesson to maybe the least, but you don't get to throw the pieces. You don't get to. That was kind of part of the lesson of how to be a loser.
Well, I like what Mish says here, basically asking his son, you know, why play a game if you're not prepared to lose? If you play a six-player game, there is a really good chance you're not going to win that game. So if you are just playing that game because you want to win, you might look into a different thing. Maybe a one-on-one game. Yes. Because you're probably not going to win. And even if you do, if winning is so important to you in that game, you're probably going to step on the fun of other players. So it's this fine balance, or at least win gracefully. Like, lose gracefully. We've been doing a lot about the sore loser, but the sore winners, the smug winners, they're worse.
They are.
Yep.
They're the ones that make me really not want to play with them. The sore losers, I commiserate. Yeah. I'm a sore loser too. I think everyone has a bit of the sore loser in them. But I also get the hindsight. Like, if I had done this, if I had done this, like, I get more mad at myself than I get at other players most of the time. Occasionally, I don't remember what game it was that Josh, he got me twice with the monster. I did.
It was the one by Eric Lang with area control.
Blood Rage?
Yeah.
Yes. Blood Rage. He just took me out twice. And it really, the first time it was him, the second time it was shame on me.
Well, it was your whole strategy was leading up to it. And I just destroyed it just before you could execute it. Yep. And it was the
way you needed to play. Oh, right. If you hadn't done that, it would have been pulling punches on me. And I understood that. And even though in that moment I was so angry and frustrated, I kept playing.
Yeah.
And I don't even think you came out that far behind. Like, you definitely felt you would have won had that move not been made.
I went from first place to last place, but it was still a spread of like
10 or 12 points. Yeah, it was really small.
It was a close game.
Yeah. So Mish goes on to say, it ties into what people play games for. For some, a fun game experience implies a balance, one where no single player pulls too far ahead of the others, where every player feels like she or he has a good chance of winning until the end. For others, a fun game experience implies exploiting a game system to their limits. I guess the answer here is to ensure that all players at the table are playing with a similar goal in mind, or to accept that not all players at the table are playing with the same goal. That is a great point, because if we're all playing to win, if we're playing the six-player game, and every single one of us are tournament level, you know, or tournament mind, say, even if it's not a tournament, but I'm going to win, I'm going to optimize the strategy to make sure you all are destroyed, but everyone's in it together, that can be a great game. It can be a heated back and forth. Everyone can come out of it really feeling good. If just one person, though, isn't really in it for that mindset, they're never going to play that game again. Like, that one person's like, this was probably the most unfriendly thing that I've ever experienced. So,
yeah, mindset matters a lot. I mean, you could even go with the mindset, I'm just going to learn from this. Even if I don't win, me learning how to play this game better and be the best at some point in the future could be me winning.
Yep.
I've learned more to care about, like, the spread. Like, not just did I win or lose, but did I get a score that was good for the game, or was I close to winning? It's when I feel like the score of the games are, like today's, it was 36, 33, 39.
I think I had 24, though. And I did have that feeling of, like, know, I'm it, out of this, like, oh, from just, very early on. And that's tough. It is tough.
That's the worst feeling for me, is being that one player at the, like, bottom of the heap. You're much better at it than I. You were such a good sport about it. You're just over there complaining about your poop-colored figurines.
They really are look like poop, and they play do. Like poop as well, so far, that I've seen in my one play.
See, I think
it's going to be Chris's, like, goal now, yeah, to good. Maximize.
Here's the strategy I'm going to use for them, because they're not good in combat, but they are good at just, like, you can put cheap units out, so then you just spread out over the entire world and do all the events.
Yeah,
because all you need to be is there. There's ways of fishing out the runes you need.
You do need the runes. Really slowed me down from getting the events. I could have won if I just had that one ruin. I had the wrong color, but that's the kind of thing. Is like, it's not. I could have won if Chris hadn't done that to me or whatever. It was. I had the wrong color in my hand. Those are the moments where I get.
Yep. If only I had that one extra card or that one more resource or...
Yeah. I feel okay being mad at the board.
Yep.
I don't like being mad at other people.
So Mish concludes, anyway, not exactly sure where I'm going with all this. I guess I don't have anyone around here to talk game talk with, so I'm inflicting it on you all. Well, you're more than welcome to. I would love it if you devoted more time to talking about game players, why they play, how they react, when they win, how they react when they lose... are there ethics to one's gaming attitude? I would listen to that. Well, hopefully that's what we've been doing. And everyone, you should know, this is a conversation. We love having this kind of feedback. But yeah, I think we all agree, essentially, playing the win is fine as long as you're also able to lose. And you're taking into consideration at least a little bit other people's fun at the table.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're looking at it from a very social gaming perspective. And I think that's great. And I think most people who listen to this are going to want to do that.
Right.
I think that there would be a great conversation to be had with someone who is a tournament level player of something to really pick apart how they psychologically psych out other people and all the strategies that they metagame people. I'd like to have that interview at some point. We should find someone like that.
All we got to do is find two Magic players.
Yes.
And then put them in a room and watch them fight it out with cardboard.
It's gonna happen.
Yeah, I think honestly tournament play and Magic gets the biggest focus of this just because it is the biggest, but if you watch tournament Magic, it can be incredibly intense, where everything you do is like, nope, you played that card, there's no take backs, nope, you did that, nope, you forgot to do this. Like, there's a lot of no, you can't, you know, not spend that mana that you just spent. You know, it's just, it's very, very cutthroat. It's not something I enjoy playing. It's why I stay out of the whole tournament.
Yeah, system. I wouldn't enjoy to play at that level either, but I think there's some interesting things to explore along the psychology of how to play the metagame in a very strategic way. And, you know, which is some of what, you know, David Serling's book goes into. And I think a player in that level would be able to explain to us a bit better about those aspects.
Yeah.
I definitely think there's different ways to do that too. There's different player types. I'm thinking more of chess than Magic, but I think it's the same kind of strategy. It's the same level of play, the same strictness of the rules where you have your hand on the piece. If you're not touching it, that's it. Your move's done. You can't. There's no take backs. They're often timed. I don't know. Is there timed Magic? Does it have to be within a time limit?
Yeah, Magic is timed. It's usually you have to play 3 games within 50 minutes. So, and there's metagame around that too, because if you get to the third game and it's a tiebreaker game, at that point, you could just be playing the clock because you just want to have the most life before the clock runs out or whatever the tiebreaker happens to be for that particular tournament. So you'll see people kind of slow playing at times. So now there's rules against slow playing. You know, you can't, you know, if you win the first game, but you draw the second game out to fill time, then you have your win. So, you know, that kind of thing. It's like, no, I'm thinking, I don't know if I should, you know, you're taking 5 minutes to take your turn. Your game in the system.
And while these are very cutthroat things, I think the interesting thing from my perspective is that a lot of these cutthroat, hard metagame strategies have real parallels for life in politics, business, whatever it is. And that's the interesting bit. It's like, wow, I could see people using that in this, you know, other situation in life.
Yep. So co-op games are a great solution to the person who wants to win, although they can also... The I must win in a co-op game could become the alpha player as well.
Right.
So they're trying to beat the board and they're more serious than everyone else at the table. But still, try co-op and try letting other people make decisions and see how that changes your gameplay.
We did talk about the group where it's five very serious players and one player who's never going to play the game again. But we did not talk about the game where it's five not so serious players and one player who is just going to make it miserable for them.
Everyone else.
I know. I have been at those tables and yeah, I'm not going back.
Yeah. And I can sometimes spot those people. So Sydney and I went to a convention in Michigan and we had signed up for a game and we were going to play Mage Knight. Now Mage Knight is a very long game. It can play 3, 4, 5 hours depending on the number of players. And we were looking, the people that were supposed to play in the game had not shown up yet. And it was like a couple of minutes past the hour. So I'm like, eh, okay, well, this is a long game anyway, so I don't mind if we don't play it. And we walked out, and I saw the two people with it, and I saw the person that was going to be running Mage Knight. Had no idea it was that person, but I'm like, that's the rest of the group. I know that's the rest of the group. But they went to the table, and they sat down, and I'm like, all right, well, we have tickets, so we should go play. That particular person was the ultra super serious. This is how we're going to play the game. These are the rules. This is what's going to happen here. This is my house rule for this. And just kind of like, and I'm just trying to smile and nod through the whole thing. I'm like, okay, okay. I can do this. Like 4 hours, I can do this. I didn't enjoy it all that much.
Very diplomatic of you.
Yeah.
It is rough when it's a long game too.
Yeah.
Because you know, it's not, you're in this for the long haul. Nope. It's not like a 15-minute thing. Nope. It's nope. You're stuck with this person for a while.
Nope. So Josh has mentioned David Serlin's book, Playing to Win, a couple times. You can actually find it at serlin.net/PTW, Playing to Win. So if you want to check that out, you should check that out there. We interviewed Serlin a couple episodes ago on Codex. So if you want to hear that interview, we did not talk about necessarily Playing to Win in that particular episode. We talked mostly about Codex and design philosophy and stuff. But I think it's an interesting topic, and I think it'll continue to come up over and over. And once you settle into a game group, because you hear this all the time, once you find a game group you like, stick with them because you know the play styles, you know the personalities, and you're going to enjoy having fun with that. But in order to find that game group, you need to play some bad games with some sore losers and sore winners.
Gotta kiss a few frogs.
Gotta kiss a few frogs. But you'll find the group. You will do it. So keep going out there. Playing to Win is not bad. It is not. Playing for fun is also not bad. So I think that it's just striking that balance. And sometimes just having fun is winning. So I think that is a show. And so Josh, why don't you take us out of here?
Thanks for listening. And remember, we love your feedback. So consider leaving us an iTunes review or email us with the comments or questions at tabletopgametalk@gmail.com. You can also reach us on Facebook @tabletopgametalkpodcast or on Twitter @tabletopgametlk. You can also reach us directly at GameMasterChris, @JoshIsBlonde, @Kittenel. And if you like what you hear, help us spread the word by liking or sharing our posts. Finally, a huge thank you to our patrons, Emil Jiljam, Lucas Hartso, Charles Finch, Trevor Olson, Rudy Liu, and Sam from New York, and Brian Arnold. If you'd like to support us via Patreon, you can find out more at tabletopgametalk.com/Patreon. All patrons are auto-entered into all our contests with bonus entries, so check it out. Until next week, when we talk with Stephen Bonacore about Stronghold Games, including Terraforming Mars, keep playing games, and having fun.
Good night.